The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Let's just jump in to talking about your book, The End of the Mega Machine. How did you come to write your book, and what was the response to your book when it was originally published in Germany?
Yes, I've been working for a long time in the global justice movement, and we were dealing in those days a lot with neoliberalism, that is to say, with the last 30 years or so, or 40 years. And the idea was that the last 30 or 40 years led us into the social crisis we have, into the climate catastrophe, and so on. And partly this is right, but I always felt that the reasons for the crisis of civilization that we are facing are much deeper. So I wanted to dig deeper, and it's not a surprise that the roots of the crises lie in the capitalist system, which is 500 years old. But you can even go deeper into the last 5,000 years, because 5,000 years ago, the first systems of domination were created, first in Mesopotamia and then elsewhere. And the capitalist system that emerged 500 years ago is based on structures of domination that are much older. So I wanted to write a sort of a history of Western civilization, which really takes on the roots of the structures of power that led us into the current crisis. Because I think when we don't know our history, it's hard to get out of our history. So that was the idea. So it's a history of Western civilization in quite a brief, in 400 pages. And the reaction in Germany was quite overwhelming indeed. We had a small publisher, but the response was very strong. People really connected to the idea to go deep into our history to understand the current crisis. And very many people came to me and said, well, for the first time in my life, I understand all these bits and pieces that I heard of in history lessons at school, and now I understand the context. Now I understand the reasons why we are in this mess. And so now it's in its 10th reprint, and there's a French edition coming out in October, and our edition with the Zero Books is coming out at the end of September.
Right. So why is it that you focused on civilization, the 5,000 years of history around civilization, rather than focusing in on capitalism? I tend to come at social criticism from the point of view of a wannabe orthodox Marxist. You know, I'm always brushing up on my Marxism and trying to develop it. And it seems to me that while it's true that you can look to a history of domination to explain the current moment, the unique thing about capitalism is it's both how it produces a kind of liberation at the same time as it deepens and totalizes another kind of domination, so that you might have had a plurality of different kinds of systems of domination before capitalism around the world. Now we have one dynamic system of both liberty in the market and domination and around production. It doesn't sound like you disagree with that idea, but what is it about the more transhistorical or the longer history that you think is compelling and that needs to be told in order to supplement or expand our understanding if we're coming at this as critics of capitalism?
Well, the core of the book is about capitalism. It's about the last 500 years. That's about two-thirds of the book. But this system has not come out of nothing. So it's very interesting. And in fact, you understand the system only if you start, if you understand its beginnings in the 14th, 15th, 16th century. Mm-hmm. And the beginning of this system were based on the old power structure. So you have to understand how the monetary systems in ancient Greece, for example, functions. That money was an invention that was not, as Adam Smith believed, for the exchange of goods and so on, but it was created for war indeed. And the same happened again in early modern times. The re-inauguration of the money system was in order to pay mercenaries and to pay all the firearms that played a crucial role in the emergence of capitalism. The warlords at that time, the princes, in fact, those who created states, they had no capital for themselves. So they were dependent on the merchants and the bankers in Genoa, in Florence and elsewhere to get the money for their conquests. And so the idea of the bankers and the merchants was, well, we lend those people, those princes, our money, they will go to war, they will loot other countries, and from this looting, we get our return on investment. That was the first thing. And the second thing was that they, they got monopolies for the credit they gave to the princes, to the sovereigns. And so capitalism was based on war from the beginning, and on monopolies. And this is very important today because you were talking about freedom in the capitalist system. And there's a lot of mythology around this. Take the freedom of the markets. Look at the 500 biggest corporations that control about 40% of global GDP. These corporations cannot live without states for many reasons. First of all, they depend on subsidies. The International Monetary Fund says that we are subsidizing the fossil fuel sector, that is coal, oil, and gas, which is driving us into the climate catastrophe, by $5 trillion every year. So these, the largest corporations, the most powerful corporations on Earth, like ExxonMobil and so on, they've been depending on subsidies for decades. And the same is true for the automobile industry, for the aviation industry, and so on and so forth. Because now in the corona crisis, you see that they get trillions of bailout dollars again. And they were talking about free markets all the time, but now in a crisis, they take the money very easily. And the same happened in 2008. And you can go back in time. This is a structural feature of what I call the mega machine, the capitalist system, that it's not based on free markets, but based on on an interlinkage between militarized states and corporations. And so you understand this much better when you go into the beginning of the system, when you see that this has been going on for 500 years. And additionally, of course, militarized states have created markets for these corporations, by conquering other territories, by providing them with slaves and later with wage labor on a cheap basis. And the same is true today. I mean, the way the American empire has been trying to maintain the influence of its corporations by military interventions is known. Everybody knows this. So this is a system that is based on militarized states and the economic power. And the third pillar is ideological power. And you find this also when you go back 5,000 years ago, the emergence of scribes in Mesopotamia, of the first caste of scribes and people who monopolized knowledge. They were working for the power, for the elites, and they were not working for the people. And you, when you look at the media system today, especially in the US, but also elsewhere, you see that our media system is very much in the hands of exactly those corporations that are devastating the planet. So you can tell this big story, but I'm not telling this because just for itself, but to understand better how the capitalist system works, because it's a total system. It's not only an economic system. It's an ideological system, a military system, an economic system, and so forth. So it's much more vast. And when we're talking about getting out of this system, which is, of course, extremely difficult, then it's very important also to know that there were other systems of domination which were as evil as capitalism is, although different. And, you know, when the system might break down, and I think it will be hard to survive the 21st century for the system for reasons that we can talk about, then we might get other systems of domination, which could be as evil as capitalism or even worse.
Okay, so on the question of the origins, of, you mentioned that the merchant classes and the banking and the bankers would lend money to princes and to states, I guess, for their military adventures, with the assurance that they would be able to get that paid back to them through the riches that these princes would loot during their conquests. But I'm wondering, when they would take this money, I'm assuming they would use the money, gold possibly, to pay soldiers. Is that right? And
yes.
And purchase weapons. Where did the soldiers go with their money? And where did the weapons manufacturers go with their money? There wasn't a global market.
Yes, exactly.
The market wasn't dominating every mode of life, so it would have to be a rather rarefied system, I guess, that soldiers alone maybe would be paid wages and get what they needed through spending their wages. So I'm wondering, like, how that arose, the market for the weapons manufacturers or the soldiers.
That's a very good question, and it leads us to the core of the emergence of capitalism. And we can go back also to ancient Greece, because the same story happened on a small scale already in ancient Greece. Mm-hmm. When you pay mercenaries with silver, then those mercenaries have to be able to buy something. And, of course, they need food. And the problem was that peasants usually worked for their own community. So they didn't sell things on the market, and they didn't want to. It's quite well proven in history that they didn't tend to sell for silver because they could not eat silver. So they produced for their own community without any money normally. And then the state again was very important, because what did the state do in order to get something for the mercenaries to buy? They changed the tax system. Usually it was the tax was given in cereals and so on, in kind. And then the tax system in ancient Greece already was switched to money. So the peasants had to sell stuff to pay the taxes. And this was a very violent system, of course. If you didn't pay your taxes, then you get enslaved or whatever. There was a lot of violence behind this tax system. So this was a circle. You taxed the peasants, and then the soldiers could buy something from the peasants. And this created the market system in ancient Greece. This was the basis for the conquests of Alexander the Great. This was an empire based on silver and on the commercialization, on the commodification of life in the Mediterranean. And this was exactly the situation as a couple of centuries later that led to the emergence of Christianity. That was an extremely violent system based on silver, based on mercenary armies, and the powerlessness of the people at those time led to all kinds of revolts, to all kinds of ideologies, including apocalyptic thinking. I talk about that a lot in the book, and to the emergence of the Jesus movement and later of Christianity, which is, of course, a completely different thing than the Jesus movement. So that was in antiquity. And in early modern times, the same thing happened. In the Middle Ages, there was hardly any money economy in Europe, and the princes desperately sought to get silver mines working. This started to happen since the 12th or 13th century, but the soldiers couldn't buy anything for that. So in the Hundred Years' War in the 14th and 15th century, that was really a crash course in market economy or in capitalism, because these huge armies of mercenaries that were created and the tax system that was switched to money really created the basis for capitalism to emerge. There were other factors, of course, but that was key.
So I was expecting the answer to be something like that the soldiers would have to purchase food from the state after the state collected food from the peasants, but instead, the peasants had to get the silver to pay their taxes. So I guess the peasants would grow food for the soldiers, but also maybe produce other kinds of like household items and things like that for the soldiers. Is that right? Or I mean, what kind of market emerged?
I mean, if you look at for example, William the Conqueror. When he and his army invaded Britain, which was a small army, by the way, maximum 10,000 people. That was that was the biggest army in the Middle Ages. Later, they were hundreds of thousands of people. But anyway, with such an army, there was a sort of market coming with the army, which was even bigger. I mean, you had people selling shoes. You had people, prostitutes selling their bodies. You had all kinds of things, not only food. So that was a crash course in market economy in a way, because everyone produced for money, not only food, and they had to do so for the taxes.
Right. And then once that was introduced, so did they also start to desire money to purchase things for themselves or trade back and forth or barter back and forth, sometimes with money between themselves? Is that like the beginnings of a market even amongst the peasants, or was it always just a matter of mostly just a matter of getting the silver to give to the king or to the prince?
Yeah, that was the first thing. Of course, when you have really a commodification of society and of everything, people start to trade with each other in that way. And of course, it was not so much about potato markets. That was also part of it, but it was about land. Who owns the land? I mean, in the Middle Ages, the land was given as a fief. It was, you could not trade land as in ancient Roman times. Roman society was quite commodified, so they could sell land, they could sell people, slaves and everything. That was not the case for most parts of Europe in the Middle Ages. And that changed, of course. So land became again a commodity, which Karl Polanyi, of course, famously pointed out that it's an absurdity. If you commodify nature, you will end up with a dead planet. That was something that he foresaw. And so the result of the commodification of land was that there were some peasants who became landowners. There was what you talked about, that capitalism also created freedom for some. Some landowners became quite well off, let's say 20% or so. But the large majority of landowners became dependent. They were indebted, and they were driven off the land, which Marx talks about in his Capital with the enclosure of the commons, which was in Britain, of course, the case in the 16th century and so on, but in many parts of Europe. So they lost their common land. They had to sell their skin, their labor, on a very brutal market, and they were persecuted by the state. I mean, the state defined those people as vagabonds. There were very harsh penalties for people who refused to take on wage labor. Mm-hmm. It's a part of the history of the labor movement that it was not only about getting better wages, less working hours, and so on, but for many centuries, many people refused to take on wage labor, even if they get more money than from the community work, because it's alienated labor. It's labor that somebody commands, and people refused to do that. Many mm-hmm. people preferred to go on the road. And to be whatever, thieves or beggars. So, and they were persecuted very harshly by the states for centuries. There were working houses created to force, to terrorize people, in fact, into wage labor. And so this is also a part of what I try to do in the book, to demystify the history of capitalism. Because when we talk about labor markets, we think that's a natural thing. Well, people sell their labor and they can negotiate and so on. But the history of labor markets, it's totally different. It's connected to the militarized power of the states, which terrorized people into wage labor for the capital owners to have cheap labor. And that happened later in the colonies, of course, in the same way, or even in a much more brutal way with slavery and so on.
Mm-hmm. So, I had a thought and now it went away. No, I remember now. I can edit. When I spoke about liberation or the freedom that arose from capitalist relations, I was thinking mostly about maybe the 19th and 20th centuries. And particularly for workers, the way in which the wage relation, and along with urbanization, it liberated the workers from their communities, and on the one hand, in a true way, and on the other hand, it kind of liberated them from their communities, the way I might liberate your wallet from your back pocket, right? I mean, it was both a theft, but it was also a kind of liberation. You can see that particularly in the women's movement. In the feminist movement, part of the struggle was to be able to get into the job market. And so the destruction of the old communal traditional forms of life was eventually seen, I would say, in late 19th and throughout the 20th century as a kind of force of liberation. And also the Marxist tradition saw capitalism as a powerful dynamic force that was liberating humanity even as it oppressed it. So the idea was that by bringing all these people together in as brutal a way as it was doing, it was ultimately going to create a working class which would be able to break free from the domination, but still use the collective power of all these people brought together. Do you think that kind of dream of collectivity and of mass production, say, and mass cooperation, and that kind of socialist dream still makes sense? Would you align yourself with that?
Yeah. First of all, I agree that there is a dialectic in all of this. Of course, right. Capitalism has not had only one effect. So it's destroyed communities. It traumatized people. It uprooted people. But at the same time, it created, as Marx and Engels famously pointed out, that conditions for overcoming capitalism as well and for new kinds of solidarity. And I think that was a very important thought in the 19th century. However, I do not agree with the idea that capitalism created liberation just like that. Because you see that when you see the political history, even the liberal class, those who called themselves liberal, in the 19th century, they were completely against voting rights for workers, people without property, for women and for people of color. That was quasi a consensus. There were some people who disagreed, but normally they didn't want these people to be part of the decision-making process. Why? Because if you have true democracy, if everyone has the same say, workers, women, and everyone, well, I think the capitalist system could not work, because this would mean that you have economic democracy as well. So people decide at the workplace what is produced, how it is produced, for what purpose it's produced, and so on and so forth. So that's why the whole class that was steering the great machine in the 19th century was so afraid of voting rights, because it's the end of the mega machine if everyone has really a say. So capitalism created a suppressive system. And concerning women rights, it was quite clear, for example, that after the French Revolution, in the Code Civil, which Napoleon introduced, women had even less rights than in the Ancien Régime before, because they couldn't make contracts. So the capitalist dynamics didn't grant rights to women. That is a mythology. The opposite is true, that the workers' movements and the women movement were opposed to the system. They didn't want just to enter the system more deeply, but they were opposed to the system. They were dreaming of a different system, which was sometimes called socialism. And that was the force that at the end of the 19th century created the conditions for changing the capitalist system, in the sense that workers got more rights, and at the end, women got voting rights, people of color got voting rights, and so on. But that was very harsh and long battles, you have to say. I mean, very many people were killed in the process, and it was not the dynamic of capitalism. It was the anti-system movements which created these conditions. And when you talk about mass solidarity and creating a different kind of social system, which is not based on communities, then I think it's a legitimate dream. And there were very good reasons to dream of this in the 19th century and early century, 20th century. But and I think we have to connect to this when we talk about post-capitalist societies. But there's, of course, a problem with this when the whole thing is based on states, because states are, when you have mass societies, in a way, always alienating structures. And we saw that after the Russian Revolution in 1917. Lenin said that he wanted to create a system which is based on the German war economy, which was a very centralized state-run capitalist economy. And he said, well, we want to have this system, but for the benefit of the workers. So it's a state monopoly. It works like capitalism, but with a state monopoly, and we redistribute the fruits of our production to the workers. And there were good reasons to try to do that in Russia, which was an agrarian society, and very backwards, and of course, the terror regime before. There were successes after the Leninist revolution in the early 20s, but in the end, it led to a state system that was alienating as well. And so I think what was important in the socialist idea was the idea of councils. And the Soviet Union, of course, means the union of councils. But Lenin was against the councils. He said before the revolution, well, people will have the control and the power. But in the end, it was clear that it will be a central state running all this. And I think this is deeply problematic. I think the idea of councils to get a solidarity, but on the, which is connected to the basis, is very important. And we have seen since then a lot of attempts to revive the idea of councils in the Spanish Republic, for example. It was very successful. It was just killed by the fascists with American aid, of course. And we saw that in the German Revolution of 1918, 1919, which was also very successful, but which was killed off by the Social Democratic Party and the fascist Freikorps at that time. And we see that again in Rojava at this very moment in the north of Syria, where they try to have a republic based on councils. I think this is, we have to connect to the socialist traditions, but we have to find ways to make sure that what we create maybe will not be another monstrum with a centralized state, but decentralized and based on councils, maybe.
Okay. What are the, in your book, you talk about the four tyrannies. What are those four tyrannies? And what are they?
The four tyrannies, they emerged with the first structures of domination 5,000 years ago, at least. Maybe you can go back even in history. The first tyranny is the tyranny of physical power. With physical violence, of course, you can find it in every society, even in indigenous societies, there's physical violence sometimes too. More or less degree, but physical power is something else. It means that you can command people by exercising physical violence or threatening to do so. And this emerged in different ways. The most perfect example is, of course, the militarized state, where a king, for example, can decide about life and death of his people. But you have also mafia structures. You have patriarchal family structures. In ancient Rome, for example, the pater familias, the father of the family, could just kill his children. There was no penalty for that. And of his slaves, of course, and he could sell people and so on. So this is physical power. And then you have structural violence, which is a notion that was coined by Johann Galtung, a peace scientists, and structural violence means violence that is more indirect. For example, property rights, which happened already in Mesopotamia in 5,000, 4,000 years ago, that land was privatized. So if some people own the land and others do not have land, they are forced to work for other people. They get indebted, they get enslaved. This is part of structural violence. And you have legal codes also saying, Code of Hammurabi 4,000 years ago, saying that if you don't pay your debt, then you will cut off a hand or whatever. So there's a mixture, of course, of physical violence and structural violence, but structural violence is the encoding and also, property rights and much more things of the sort. So for today, it's, yeah.
Okay. So I wanted to ask you about this idea in ancient Rome, that the father could just kill his children and get away with it. The dark side of me thought, well, if I had lived in that time, of course, all of my children would be dead now. But at one point or another, I would have done them all in. But it seems to me that if that was really happening, that kind of violence could not have existed in a different kind of community, that you would have to have had a structural violence before you could have that individuated violence from the father. And I'm interested to know, like, what purpose did it serve to give the fathers that kind of power in that community? What was the social function of that kind of abuse of authority? Because if it didn't have any, and if it was like against the needs of the community as a whole, it wouldn't have it continued to exist. Because one of the things that I tend to think is that the history of society, the history of different forms of life, is the history of us trying to work out ways to survive. And you know, it includes domination, but it also tends to be, as well as along with being coercive, always also cooperative around some idea, around some way of life. So I'm wondering, what was the structural preconditions that made it seem at all sane to give fathers the right to kill their children?
Yeah, I mean, the idea, of course, was not that people sit around a table, everyone sits around a table, and then decide which is the best way to ensure the survival community.
Right.
That's why it's interesting to tell all this story, because 5,000 years ago, when domination emerged in the way we know it today, that was an accident of history. As Michael Mann, a sociologist, pointed out, I think he was right to do so, that most communities have measures to prevent this thing from happening. If you look at indigenous communities, if they have so many mechanisms to ensure that not a specific type of people will monopolize knowledge, power, and so on. And there are also traditions like a potlatch, people collecting goods and burning them or throwing them into the ocean to prevent the accumulation of property in some hands. Or other communities have the idea that if you have a lot of property, you will have to take on political responsibility and spend all this for other people to invite them. So the property will be gone. So all these are mechanisms to stop domination before it emerges. Mm-hmm. And because you have always people who have some kind of mental problems or who feel they have to grab power to feel good. I mean, this is a normal human thing that some individuals have this tendency, and often they are male, not always. And so when domination was created 5,000 years ago, that was in a way an accident. And you have to see that 195,000 years before, I mean, Homo sapiens has existed for 200,000 years. Probably we didn't have this kind of thing. So, but the problem is once it happens, once you, for which reasons ever, no matter what the reasons are, when a system is in place, then it is, it feeds itself in a way. And, it was to come back to your question precisely. The Roman society was, as the ancient empires in Mesopotamia, a military society. And the military creates all sorts of things. First of all, it needs people to be subdued, people to be conquered. It creates also a psychological traumatism, which goes for the soldiers as well as for those who are conquered. Because if your job is to kill people all the time, what will you do at home? I mean, we have a lot of studies of what this does today with people coming back from Vietnam or Iraq or whatever. I mean, these people in ancient times had post-traumatic stress disorders as well. So there's a psychological part of it. And of course, if men once have a privilege and they have this situation in place, it's very hard to let this go. The same is true with slavery, for example. If you say, well, we'll leave all these slaves free, I mean, people fear that they will take revenge for what you did to them all the time. That's why it's self-feeding. It's very hard to get rid of domination once it's in place.
And in the case of African slave trade, you can see the social function quite clearly. There was a continent to cultivate, a growing global market, and the need for a massive amount of cheap labor. And so slaves were a solution for that problem.
Yeah.
But that didn't, sure. I mean, it wasn't a solution for the slaves, but it was a solution for this global system of power.
That's what I mean. I mean, you have systemic necessities. And it's very important to understand that today as well, that it's not when we're talking about the financial crisis. And so there was a lot of talk about individual greed by bankers and so on. That might be the case. There are sometimes evil people, greedy people everywhere. But the main thing is the institutions, which have certain demands. When you are the CEO of a large corporation, then your only aim in this legal structure or where you are in is to make sure that the dividend and the shareholder value goes up, or not goes down at least. If you do not do this, then you are out within months, within days sometimes. So it's the function, it's the structure that determines behavior. And of course, behavior determines structures as well, but we have to change structures. We have to change the way our economy is run and not just appeal to individual behavior. So this is very important. But I would like to come back also to the four tyrannies, because you asked about four.
You named one of them, right? So yeah, go ahead and name the other three.
We had physical violence, we had structural violence, and then we have ideological power. And ideological power also emerged 5,000 years ago, maybe earlier, with the scribes, who were serving.
You know, you got a little something on your lip. Wipe your lip and then keep going. Just wipe your lip a little bit up with, perfect. That way I'm going to edit that part out.
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you. this emerged 5,000 years ago also with in Mesopotamia with the scribes who were working for the kings. And the scribes, first of all, they had lists with the slaves and goods. So writing was not invented to write poetry or drama or whatever, or declarations of human rights, but it was basically technology for slavery and for the trading of goods. But the scribes had a very important function in the system. They worked for the kings. And later on, when the writing was used for other purposes, those elites were able to have their mythology, their ideology written in words and written in stone, written on papyrus and on other materials. And so they had a kind of eternity to them that the oral traditions did not have. But of course, writing did not remain a monopoly of the elites. There were, for example, the first prophets, which you find in the Bible, Amos and others, they were revolting against the powers of their times, against exploitation, against concentrated land ownership, and so on. And they were using writing as well. And so this is something that we see until today, that media are very often in the hands of the powerful to justify the system in place, to say that it's the best system ever created, that it has come from God or whatever is the narration of the time. But there are also other people who can pick up the same tools, be it writing or be it the internet or other media, to tell a different story. And so this is a field that is very much disputed. And we saw in the 19th century, for example, the emergence of a great working press, a working class press. And then we had at the end of the 19th century a concentration in media. We had all these media moguls like Hearst and like Gutenberg in Germany, who had all the a lot of power in their hands and to beat the drum for war and to mystify capitalism and so on. So today, the history of the working class in this respect is that as soon as people got the power to vote in the early 20th century in most countries, the elites really had a problem because they could vote for a government that was going to abolish capitalism. So you need to control public opinion. That is what Walter Lippmann famously wrote in the 1920s, and Edward Bernays and other people. And they were saying, well, we have now tools in our hand within a democracy to control the minds of people. Of course, you cannot control the minds of people. This is also mythology. But of course, you can influence what people think when you tell them all the time that Saddam Hussein is the most evil person on the planet and he has all kinds of weapons of mass destruction and we have to kill him before he kills us, and you hear only that, then people will say, well, maybe we have to go to war. So it's an enormous power. And it was in a way used and created because of the successes of the working class and of the women movements and of the black movements to have at least voting rights. And so the media and ideological power is key in changing the system. And that is why alternative media, like Democracy Now! In the US, are so important. Media that are not in the hands of the corporate elites or the state.
So what is your idea of revolution without a master plan?
Yeah. But let me first finish the four tyrannies. There's
okay.
One,
oh, yeah, there's one more, right? Oh, okay.
The fourth tyranny.
Right.
Which is what I call the tyranny of linear thinking. From the
This is the one where I'm going to disagree with you, I think. I like linear thinking, but go ahead.
Yeah, we can talk about this.
yeah.
The tyranny of linear thinking is that you think that natural systems, living beings, societies can be controlled according to a causal chain. A leads to B. And so if I know A, I can manipulate the world in a way that B comes out. And this comes from the idea that if I'm the king, my people will obey. This comes from the idea that if God commands, then his people will follow. So it's deeply rooted in the history of domination. And it was, in the early modern times, converted to the idea that man can dominate the creation, can manipulate the creation. I mean, Francis Bacon famously wrote his New Atlantis, where he invented, in fact, all the things that we have now, like geoengineering and manipulating of plants, genetic engineering. He figured that out already. It's really amazing. That was deeply rooted in the early modern times and the idea that we can manipulate nature. Unfortunately or fortunately, living systems were completely different. They're not based on linear causal change, but on circles. And so if you do X, there's not the outcome Y, but also Z and B and C at the same time. And a lot of it is not foreseeable. And there is still this idea around that we can cope with climate change, for example, by geoengineering, by just putting sulfur in the atmosphere or whatever. These are proposals by Paul Crutzen, for example. And this is extremely dangerous because also the climate system works differently. When we do something to the climate system, it will react in unforeseeable ways because it's based on cycles, because it's non-linear, and in parts it's non-deterministic. You have to think about modern physics and chemistry and so on. And if you put a lot of sulfur in the atmosphere, you risk to have the monsoon going away from India or parts of Africa, and you have maybe billions of that because you try to manipulate a system that is way more complex than our little minds are able to understand. And so this is what I call the tyranny of linear thinking, the hubris to think that our mind, which is very much able to control how billiard balls function or even send a rocket to the moon or whatever, but complex systems are beyond our understanding, in fact, most of the time. So these are the four tyrannies, but I think you had another question.
I want to jump in and say, well, what if we had a supercomputer that could think non-linearly, that we programmed to do non-linear analysis, and we wouldn't dump sulfur into the atmosphere, but we would intervene in some way or another to change the global environment consciously rather than changing it the way we're doing it now, which is unconsciously and without purpose or not. It's a byproduct of another aim that we have. What if we would you oppose a global intervention, an act that we might make other than changing or curbing what we're doing? But, you know, we'd have to obviously limit the amount of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere. But along with that, would you oppose some sort of global coordinated effort to bring down the global temperature?
It depends what it is. I would not oppose to plant trees on a huge scale, which is you can also call geoengineering, and there are very beneficial effects of that. You cannot keep up with this kind of intervention with the emissions, so we have to go down very rapidly with the emissions and plant the trees. But coming back to your idea that a supercomputer could calculate that better than we do, just to give you an idea of the complexity of living systems. A single cell of our body contains about 10 billion molecules. Most of them are even in it.
Yeah, but they're mostly all alike. You don't have to worry about every one of them, right? You know, they're mostly the same. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Just let me make this point.
Yeah.
10 billion. So Dennis Noble, an Oxford biologist, a famous biologist, just calculated how many computers you need to calculate what is going on in this single cell. And it turns out it's 10 how do you call it? 10 up 27?
Mm-hmm. 10 to the power 27?
Yeah, 10 by... Yeah. So it's an incredible number. And you would need all the material and more of our solar system to build those computers to calculate really what is happening in one single cell. it's incredibly complex. And then you, when you go to the quantum level, which is also real, it's even more complex. And then you have, like, in our bodies, billions and billions of these cells working together in a coordinated way. And then you have the biosphere where billions and billions and billions of beings, it's the complexity is so far beyond anything that a computer could simulate. And it would take all the time that the universe has to just have one single cell simulated. And in the meantime, the cell has changed or has died. So all your calculation is nonsense. So this is what I call hubris. The idea that we can understand this, or computer can do so. Computer are much weaker than we think.
Yeah, but I know you're right. But here's my counter to this, and then I'll ask you my final question. It's true that we probably can't fully model the universe, even in, you know, the best computers, like one that is going to come out from Apple next week. Probably won't be able to handle the whole thing. But on the other hand, we also don't know. No. That the natural world as it is now will sustain itself, or that there's actually no, given how complex the world is, even if we do nothing, it could collapse into complete chaos. There's no reason to believe that the world of nature is any more stable without our intervention than it would be with it, right? If it's really opaque.
No, that's not quite true.
Why not?
You're completely right that nature in itself is not necessarily stable. I mean, we had five events of mass extinction in the history of the planet. There were more, but these were the big five. And some were caused by bodies from outer space hitting the Earth. Others were caused by internal reasons. So we can have natural collapses without human beings. Of course, we are not the only species that could do something like that. But the fact is that without us, the biosphere would be at least stable for a couple of million of years.
How do you know that? Do you have a supercomputer
we know path dependencies. And of course, we cannot know. It could happen that a body from outer space hits us tomorrow. I mean, there's no way
I guess my point is that when you project stability into the future, you're doing a calculation based on doing nothing, just in the same way as you would be doing a calculation of some sort of modeling based on intervening. Your limit to your knowledge about what the future is going to be like is the same limit, whether or not you're intervening or not. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is not true. But because, for example, let's take you have an aquarium at home. So it's like a biotope. It's like a small ecological system. So you know it works. You know the turtles are not eating the fish, and so in a way it works. It's sort of stable. You don't know if it will be stable tomorrow, but it has worked for some years. And so you now think, well, let's put a lot of iron or sulfur in it. The probability is quite high that you will destroy the system, because you see it has a sort of equilibrium, which is never 100% stable. There's always change in nature. There's nothing static in nature. But if you intervene in a complex system, the probability to destroy is much higher than the probability that it is all right.
Well, okay. But the only reason I would intervene in my aquarium is if something was already going wrong. Maybe I'd fed the fish too much, right? Maybe I'd put too much fish.
The better thing is to do to feed the fish better.
Well, I'd obviously have to do that, right? I'd obviously have to change how I was feeding the fish, but it could be that I've done enough damage that I may need to do something to intervene to undo some of the damage that I've already done. If I assume that not doing something to undo the damage is going to be the safer bet, that I'm still making a calculation based on the complexity of my own understanding about what's going on in the fish tank, rather than only making that calculation if I do intervene. Like I have to make a decision one way or the other, whether to intervene when something that I've done is going to make things go out of control, or even if something's going on and I haven't done it, I still have to make the decision based on my own understanding either way.
Yeah. But you, I think you are talking about I make a decision, but the reality of our social and planetary system is very different from this example. I mean, who is intervening? We are intervening all the time, and some are doing this much more than others. The global elites, the global 20% of world population, are responsible for 80% of the CO2 emissions. So these people would have to stop intervening. This would be
I agree totally. We'd first have to have our workers' revolution.
We should make them stop doing so, which is part of the social and ecological revolution that we need in any case. And so I think what we should talk instead, and if we have geoengineering, those same elites would do it on their behalf, not on our, not on the behalf of the 80%. So the thing, I think the thing to focus on is not a technological fix that we don't know if it works and which could make things worse, but on the feeling that so many people on the planet now have that there's something profoundly wrong with the system. I mean, capitalism is not very much on vogue. People do not like capitalism. And this is a chance for social and ecological movements. And I think the key thing is to have a convergence of these movements. We saw that a little bit with the Bernie Sanders campaign, that Black Lives Matter, workers' movements, ecological movements, they came a little bit together. Now, the Bernie Sanders campaign has broken down. What we don't know what will come out of the movements. I think it's crucial that these movements really converge now with a perspective to overcome the system in the long run. And this is key. And the technologies we use for this or that are part of the movements and of the ideas that they propose.
Yeah, I'm totally with you that if we act to intervene in the environment to bring down I'm hearing an echo and right now, let's see if I can lower my voice and not hear it. Okay, if we act to intervene in the environment to bring down the global temperatures without first changing the way that we produce goods for ourselves and trying to limit the amount of waste that we put out into the atmosphere. And if we're basically still driven by the same economic and political forces that we're driven by now, the chances that a good outcome will come of that are very, very extremely low. I'm just saying after a revolution, say, it might be necessary to do some sort of global coordinated intervention to undo some of the damage or to mitigate some of the effects of the damage.
Yeah, there are lots of ways to do this. One of the key things that is hardly talked about is agriculture. You can suck out of the atmosphere a lot of CO2 and prevent emissions in the first place by changing agriculture from the way we do agriculture now, which is not the only destroying the climate, but also our soils, which is also depleting our freshwater resources, which is a very deep crisis that we will soon be in. And if you change agriculture to dynamic peasant agriculture, basically, which is the special rapporteur on the right to food in the UN also says that we have to change the system in that way to make sure that we will feed the world population without destroying the planet. You can stop 30% of carbon emissions and even suck CO2 out of the atmosphere. This, you can call this geoengineering if you like, but it's a completely different thing. You can be quite sure, not perfectly sure, but the prospect that you do something good for the people and the planet is quite high. And it can be done quickly. And it can be done at low cost. You just have to cut the subsidies for all the agricultural corporations, and you have to convert the subsidies to this kind of farming. This can be done quickly. And we have in the EU at least a discussion about this, at least. So after decades of fighting, we have a little discussion about this. I don't know how it is in the US.
So let me ask that last question that I was going to ask you, which is, what is your idea of for a revolution without a master plan?
Yeah, I try to coin this term because I think that master plan would be desirable in some way, but at the same time, it's not realistic for the whole world. I mean, the problem with revolutions in the last hundreds of years was that you have a revolution like in France in the 18th century or in Russia in the early 20th century in one country. And what do the other countries do? They will attack you. They will wage war on you. And then you have all the logic of militarization to defend yourself, and you end up with a state that looks quite similar to the state that was there in the first place. So the idea is how to make all the different movements all over the world converge in a way that we have changed, not in the same way that it was imagined in the early 20th century. And I think this is necessary because the capitalist system has not been overcome in 500 years. It can only be overcome, I think, if it decays in a way. And this is will be probably the case in the 21st century because of the ecological collapse that we have. Every social system is a subsystem of the ecological system of planet Earth. If you destroy the ecological systems that are life-supporting, like water and the atmosphere and so on, every economic system will collapse. There's no reason that capitalism will be eternal. All other systems have collapsed. This is the fate of all living structures and of social systems as well. We don't know when it will happen. But a system that like that, one civilization decaying, other things coming up, we see that in the past, the decay of the Roman Empire and something new coming up. This is a very complex process, and it is not linear in the way that you can say, well, this system out and we have a plan for the new system in. It never works like that historically. It's too complex. Not a single part of the people can dominate the whole process, even if they wish to. So it's a complex process which consists in different phases. One phase is long periods where you think there's nothing happening. The old power elites are very much in power. And then you have crises, like the financial crisis 2008, like the corona crisis now, like ecological crises that are ahead of us. And in these crises, things can go one way or can go another way. So you need a plan for these crises. This is different from a master plan for the whole thing. You need a plan, for example, what to do in the next crisis, what to do when we have the next pandemic, when we have the next financial crisis. Social movements should prepare for this. Ecological movements should prepare for this, to use the power vacuum and the disorientation on the part of the elites in these things and the ideological ruptures in these situations to push ahead, to push for progressive policies, which drives the system to its limits, to use the money instead of bailouts for the corporations for the social and ecological transition. And when you do this in one crisis and you have some success in one crisis, you're better prepared for the next crisis. And when you go from crisis to crisis over decades, and this is what we have when we have systemic transitions, it's not one year, one revolution, then you're better prepared to really go beyond the limits of the system, to do something else than capitalism. And this way could be very different in one part of the world than another, because ecological circumstances are different. Past dependencies are different. People wish different things. So you cannot have this for the whole planet, but you can have plans for specific crises. And then you go on. And then you have the convergence of movements who agree to work together on certain things and not on other things, maybe. And so you can influence a nonlinear process in the way that the outcome will be more probably something that is better than capitalism than something that might be worse than capitalism. So the idea is not to have a master plan, is not to have no plans. It's very important to have plans, but to be aware that the system is too complex to have one plan finished in one revolution. It doesn't work like that.